accession number 31680, reel number 1.
Jet reel 1, if we could start with when and where you were born.
Well, I was born in the Lake District at near Penrith in Cumbria on the 18th of July 1923, so I'm 85. Yeah.
You grew up around in the Lake District?
Yes, I grew up there. I was the son of fairly elderly parents. Particularly my father was 20 years older than my mother and was 56 when I was born. She was 36. And I went to the local village school and then to the grammar school, Queen Elizabeth Grammar School in Penrith, which had been founded in 1564 and which was, you know, as grammar schools went, I think, fairly outstanding. It was co-educational, but they had some teachers who I think were lured to going up there by the thoughts of fell walking and mountaineering, and they were an exceptional lot, I thought, who stayed all the time. And I was there in years before and afterwards, really. And particularly some of the men, particularly the one who was my form master for 2 or 3 years, who was an English master. I now, looking back, realize he was an outstanding influence on. Well, I've been able to write English and to understand grammar and go into things like analysis and parsing and so on. So it was something that I don't think everybody got, from what I gathered, really.
You enjoyed school then?
I did enjoy school, yes. Mm. And at the end of it, I wanted to go in for flying. I've been always been interested in this because I had this, as I explained, I had this cousin who was in age like an uncle to me, who had the exact same names as me, William Edward Barjett, and had flown in 74 Squadron with Mickey Mannock, who was the kind of great ace of the British side in the First World War in the Royal Flying Corps. And this cousin used to come and see us. He'd become he'd gone back to university after the war and had become a metallurgist for the United Steel Companies. But I could always persuade him to talk to me about SE-5As and Sopwith Camels and how he'd learned to fly on a thing called the Morris Farman Shorthorn, which had elevators at the front, and it would seem like a very, the sort of thing you can just see at the Shuttleworth collection these days. I became interested in that. I used to take, as a schoolboy, I used to take a magazine called Popular Flying, which I think was edited by W.A.E. Johns, the man who wrote all the Biggles stories. I don't know whether I knew W.E. Johns was at one stage employed as a kind of a recruitment officer in London, I think, for the Air Force, because I think T. Lawrence of Arabia once went to see him and realized it was W.E. Johns of Biggles. So that was an influence, but perhaps an influence of many of my generation, because there were lots of air-minded people. And I think the other thing that probably the government was behind was Sir Alan Cobham's air circuses, which toured around the country with ex-Air Force biplanes, usually some of them bigger than others. An early, not a helicopter, but an autogyro, and early Fox Moths and Avro Tutors and Airspeed, something in Handley Page, something or other, early aircraft. And you got a chance to see all of those, and you got a chance to have a flip around for about 5 shillings. So that was in about 1935. I must have been 12. Then when I volunteered for pilot training, as soon as I left school, really, I was put on deferred service because they said there had got so many people. And I got a job in a bank. And then someone in the bank, who was a rather father figure to me, said, had I noticed that in some booklet he had, that people could apply to go on an RAF short course at a university if you had the right academic qualifications and were a member of the Air Training Corps, which I had joined. And so I applied for this and went to interviewed at Padgate near Warrington by, I think, about three elderly Air Force people of some experience, air commodores and so on. And that ended by my going to Durham. They gave me the chance of going to Oxford, but they said you'll have to have some private means if you go to Oxford. Would your father be able to supply you with those? And in a moment that changes your whole life, I said, well, I don't know. His business had suffered from the war. It was in the animal feeding stuffs. He had an animal feeding stuffs business. I said, I don't know whether he'd really want to. He probably would. But because I hesitated, they said, well, you go to Durham. You'll be all right there. You're in the northern. So I might easily have gone to a different university, which might have affected my life, but I don't know if it would have affected it very much at all. And so I eventually went on this six-month course at Durham University. There were 60 of us. 30 went to one college, University College, which is in Durham Castle, and 30 to Hatfield College. We were just the first part of the alphabet, all the bits from M to Z, the other part, in our surnames. And we went through, in the mornings we studied mechanics, mathematics, physics, and so on, as part of a BSc course. And in the afternoons, we studied Air Force subjects like Air Force law, navigation, meteorology, aircraft recognition. And we also marched up and down and did all the square bashing and stuff to quite a high standard, I think. And because we were complimented when we all came out through this. We weren't paid. We were sort of air cadets, really. And it was a very good course and made friendships that I stayed on till today, really. And whether going through this university air squadron course eventually meant that I ended up on flying boats, which turned out to be a much safer thing than bomber command, or not, I don't know. I don't think there was any direct connection that they were following these people and saying that we'd better steer them onto flying boats. I think it was just that we'd studied things to a slightly higher academic level, and when it came to ground school subjects in the various training courses we did in Canada, it wasn't difficult to get 100% in this, that, and the other, and come top of the course in things like aircraft recognition. You were either right or not. You either knew a Vulti Vengeance from a Vought Corsair, or you didn't do it. And I suppose, and my flying was above average, but it wasn't excellent or anything. But it meant I ended up as top of these courses, and you were called out first to get your wings or whatever it was. And then I think they creamed off the people at the very top to go firstly onto a course that took you into Coastal Command, which was called a General Reconnaissance Course, or GR School. It was really a maritime reconnaissance course. And there were a number of these. There were two in Prince Edward Island, and there was another one in South Africa, George in South Africa. I went on one of the Canadian ones in Prince Edward Island at Summerside, and at the end of it, all they said was, well, you're definitely going into Coastal Command, and they gave you a choice. And my first choice, well, the first one they offered me was to go on to Liberators at in the Bahamas at Windsor Field near Nassau. But in fact, I didn't go there because my mother got in touch with me and said my father had been ill and when would I get home. So I thought, well, I've heard that if you went to Nassau, you'd probably go from there to the Far East by going across the States. So I said, well, I think I'd rather go back to England and see my father at least, who was elderly then, and then see where they post me. So suddenly I didn't go to Liberators, and the chap who took my place eventually caught up with me in Harrogate, and he'd done that course, and he hadn't gone to the Far East, so it didn't make a lot of difference. But all these little tiny things change where you go and what you do.
Just to pause there and go back a little bit.
Yes.
When was it that you were at Durham?
Well, on that first course, was 1942, from August to September. And it meant that I was able to go back, although I didn't decide on this immediately, when I was demobbed at the end of 1946, in October 46. And I then, instead of going back and studying science subjects, which I had been studying, I went back and did a degree in politics and economics, because I'd become interested in... I'd done some economics in my banking exams that I'd been taking in the first years of the war, but I'd also become interested in the ideas of a man called C.E.M. Joad, Cyril Edwin Mitchinson Joad, who was a professor at Birkbeck College in the London University, who was a member of the so-called Brains Trust, who with two or three other people, Julian Huxley was another one, sort of answered questions from listeners on the radio. And a lot of them were about philosophy. And I began to be interested in, I suppose, in ideas, really, as well as just people and things. And so at the end of the war, I wanted to go back and do something that wasn't a school subject, but something quite different, which I enjoyed tremendously, although at the end of it I wondered, where is it going to lead me? But I eventually went to be a hospital administrator, simply because I wanted... I thought the NHS was something new and interesting coming up, and I've been happy to have done that afterwards.
Had you then had any particular career ambitions as you were going through school before the war started?
Well, I think that was one of the snags of being... I wouldn't say I had, because... my father's business, he'd inherited an old water mill, really, with some of his brothers. They'd diversified to other mills. They'd all stayed in this sort of world, and then they did retailing through a warehouse they had of animal feeding stuffs. I didn't really think this was me. I didn't think it would really sort of satisfy the ideas I was beginning to have, really. And also, when the war came, there was terrific rationing of animal feeding stuffs as well as to human beings, and so he was finding it very difficult financially, I think. So I never pursued that any further. But what would I have wanted to do? I think I was rather caught up in the whole aviation idea. I might easily have stayed in civil aviation, and I almost did do at the end of the war, but I finally decided that, having done politics and economics, I ought to use my brain a bit more, much as I would have liked to have done turns into the runway and approaches and so on. But I don't know whether that would have been quite what I really would have wanted to spend my life doing. That's what I thought at that time.
Would you be able to talk a little bit about Penrith itself as a town and community before the war?
Yes, well, Penrith lies between edge of the Lake District, between the Pennine Range of mountains, the backbone of England, and the Lake District. And I was born at this old and brought up at this old water mill, which was about 2 miles out of Penrith towards Ullswater, which is one of the lakes there. And Penrith itself was a market town, which had a market day when the farmers and their wives went to the men would go to a sort of agricultural market where they bought and sold cattle and perhaps pigs and maybe sheep, for all I know. And the ladies would go into a large market hall with their butters and cheeses and other things they'd made and so it was a sort of community that I suppose goes back, you know, the sort of Thomas Hardy days in Dorset, really. It was idyllic in some ways, but I don't know that I was old enough to appreciate that, really. It had its own sort of interest going. My father belonged to a literary and philosophical society, which I think was a a kind of popular thing in the early part of that century. And there was an amateur dramatic society that I joined called the Penrith Players, and learnt a bit about, I suppose, to do any dramatics is always a help in almost whatever you do, really. But it was a country market town on a fairly small scale, I think with about 8 or 10,000 inhabitants. And I was even out in the sticks from that, so I was brought up very much on my own. I had various relatives came to play with me at the weekends, or other boys from the school came down to this water mill, which was quite fun to play in. I mean, I learned to swim there in the river, and we used to ride around on bicycles. And I think we all even were interested in aviation then, because we pretended we had some sort of flying control tower in this mill, so it must have infected us all, really. Childish stuff, really, in a way.
How did the area fare in the
economically? I think in the war years, I don't think it was too bad. Well, there was the usual rationing and so on, but certainly when I eventually ended up in Newcastle for a while in the health service after going back to Durham for 3 years, I think Penrith was regarded as a place that during the war had done rather well. I think because there must have been, to some extent, some sort of bartering would go on with people who say, I'll let you have a dozen eggs if you'll let me have, you know, a chunk of bacon that would not normally have been on ration but was available in the next farm, and so on. I wasn't really aware of that happening openly, but I think they probably... I mean, I once met a farmer who said the great thing about farming is you may not make a lot of money, but you live well because the stuff you're producing is there to be eaten and so on.
And what about then in the late 20s and early 30s?
Well, I was born 23, so I suppose that I was aware of the depression that came along. I wasn't too much aware about unemployment, I don't think, in that part of Cumbria. Although much later I was aware that out in West Cumberland, where I worked for 2 or 3 years later in my career, there had been a terrific unemployment. And in a place called Maryport, the men, I heard, were so ashamed of being unemployed, it was said they stayed in bed during the day and got up in the evenings to walk about in the evening so that they weren't seen as being unemployed by other people, which I thought was a terribly sad thing because it wasn't their fault. They're unemployed, not directly anyway. So I don't think we were hit too much by the depression, but my father's business was, he had a lot of customers, farmers, who ran up bills, and he would just call them bad payers, and they really... Well, they didn't make him bankrupt, but I know he had a lot of worries and overdrafts because he didn't get paid promptly, and he was they were living on tick at his expense, I think, to some extent. So it was a tight and difficult time, which I hope we're not going to go through that again, but we might have.
Did your mother work?
No, my mother was the daughter. She had two brothers. Of a farmer who had a very tall and handsome chap with a beard, looked like Captain Justice in one boy's magazine, who had been a farm manager firstly for the Duke of Northumberland over in Alnwick, and then for Lord Broom, who had some farms and a stately home up there, but they were gradually that sort of bit of landed gentry, I think, ran into money troubles themselves. And my grandfather had bought one of these farms from his previous employer, I don't know how he managed to do that, and rented another one and put his two sons in that, and then his third child would be my mother, And although she would work, she did work, I think, initially in Alnwick for the Duke of Northumberland, some just domestic job, really, in the Alnwick Castle, I think it was, long before I was born. And then she met my father, who was lived in this water mill not very far away, about 3 or 4 miles away, really. And they got married in 1918, I suppose, just when a lot of people were coming back from the war, but my father was too old to be in that war, because he was born in 1868, so he was getting on in years. And I don't know, they seemed, from the photographs I've seen, they seemed to have a big wedding with lots of people there and so on. And I was the procreation from that 5 years after they were married, really.
You mentioned that the teachers at your school were drawn by the area itself.
Yes.
And walking and mountain area. Was that something that was passed on to the students?
Well, I think to some extent it was. I remember these farm masters taking groups that was, I think, boys and girls on fell walking expeditions, and there was certainly a sports master who encouraged all kinds of it was a sort of rugby, football, and other things. But we didn't really get to the tops of the main mountains, the Skaw Fells and Helvelland, but we did a lot of fell walking on Barton Fell and on the sides of Ullswater, really, and Gowborough was another area. So it was a healthy sort of existence, and the school had the, by the wisdom of some characters in the town who were on the governors of the school, had, before I went there, had an extensive science block built, one part of which was a chemistry laboratories with benches and sinks and taps and Bunsen burners and so on. Another part of the physics laboratory, which had things like Fletcher's trolley, on which I think you could show by means of an oscillating gadget being pulled along by weights how there was both speed and acceleration and what were the relationship of this and the other, something like S equals half a two squared or something. At any rate, I've forgotten the exact formula, but there was a formula that you could work out by experimental physics, really. I was quite interested in that then, and somehow I got interested in things that were I thought were wider ranging than that, like what the Greeks had been thinking in 5th century BC or something. Then perhaps one's life is just ideas that deflect you from one thing to another, really. I'm sure, I don't know why I should be giving you all my ideas, and I'm sure you have much more interesting ideas yourself.
How much were you aware of what was happening in Europe during the 30s?
Well, not nearly as much as I should have been. I wasn't aware. I mean, my eldest daughter here at the Imperial War Museum has been much involved with the Holocaust exhibition and so on, and met a lot of people from families who suffered terribly in the concentration camps and extermination camps and so on. Most people were unaware. I think perhaps everybody was unaware of that at the time. But some people had gone on holidays to Germany, and I think they realized something rather nasty was beginning to arise. But I think it was only at the time, 1938, the first thing that was happening at that time filled everybody's minds was in 1936, was not the war, but the apparent scandalous relationship between the heir to the throne, who was became Edward the VIII and became the Duke of Windsor, and this American divorcee, Mrs. Simpson. And that filled all the newspapers. And I remember in 1936, everyone at the school on some open day stopped to hear the abdication speech by the king who hadn't been crowned, but had been, well, his father had died, King George V, who'd had a silver jubilee when I was at school. And everyone seemed to be full of that. And then the next thing I remember after all that, although people took sides on that, some people thought, you know, particularly ladies, one met occasionally, thought, love is everything, and they could sort of ride over and anything, whether they are divorced or whatever. Other thought, outrageous, we can't have any divorced people. But it was all sort of their own personal attitudes. But shortly after that, I remember the Munich crisis, which would be 1938, and Chamberlain coming back to Northolt, and I forget what sort of, I would be more interested in the type of aircraft he came in, really. But at any rate, he came back saying that peace in our time, etc. But it was really probably stalling for time to get the place, the country rearmed. And I used to go on holidays to stay with some cousins in Yorkshire, who were just a little bit older than me. The last of them has only recently died, aged 89 or something, in near Ilkley. And they told us about how on the side of a hillside at Yeadon, a huge underground factory was being built. I thought this is one of these stories that one heard, shadow factories. Were these things really being built? I didn't really believe it, but later I learned that Avro from Manchester had in fact built this underground factory, and a lot of major stuff was being constructed for the production of aircraft in those years, 38, well, up to the outbreak of war. And when we went to see some other relatives down in Stony Stratford, various other relatives would congregate, and they would all have these sort of slightly, should we talk about the items about airfield developments and what they were, what was happening in the air. It was all very similar, really, sort of mainly aircraft production, but also development of airfields on a big scale. So then, I suppose, I remember, as everybody remembered, the day war broke out on the 3rd of September 39, and the speech by Chamberlain, which everybody remembers. I have to say that no such note has been received from them, and they protested about the invasion of Poland, that if he didn't receive that note, we would be in a state of war, and there we were. Well, nothing much happened. It was a phony war until about 1940. A lot of troop movements, a lot of lorries moving around the countryside with cheerful soldiers with tin hats putting their thumbs up, but we couldn't see anything really happening. But there perhaps were master plans going of, really, I suppose, to prepare for a possible invasion, I would think.
What was your own reaction to the news of the declaration of war?
Well, I wish I could say that I'd had anybody strong views. I think I don't know that I was old enough and wise enough to have thought much about it, but I think I felt we were glad we were standing up to the Nazis at last, but that probably, however Chamberlain was sort of criticised at the time, and then Churchill came on and took over from him, it was probably the right thing to do to have gained time for rearmament. Rearmament was a big issue, I thought, and some of the press barons like Lord Northcliffe, I think it was the Daily Express, had put a lot of money into development of things like the Bristol Blenheim, and they've financed all that. And it gave us time to almost get ready, because the Germans had obviously stolen a march on us with development of gliding and glider training, and then open training of air crews and development of aircraft before they invaded Poland, really. Mm. So I was more watching, I suppose I was more at that stage watching the technicalities of it rather than thinking of the big issues of it.